Good morning, and welcome to the Jewish Policy Center conference call. I'm Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director of the Jewish Policy Center and your host. We have a very large audience today, which makes us very happy. Keep sending those invitations to your friends. So let me introduce you to the JPC and our work. We are a 501c3 organization providing perspectives and analysis on foreign policy and domestic issues by scholars, academics, and commentators. You can sign up for our articles published under the heading of Insight. You can see our quarterly magazine, In Focus, and you can see our blog, In Context, all on our website at www.jewishpolicycenter.org. I know it's a mouthful, www.jewishpolicycenter.org. The JPC supports a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and missile defense. We support the legitimacy and security of Israel against anyone who would deny those things. As an organization that sits slightly to the right of center, the JPC advocates for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, energy security, and most important these days, free speech and intellectual diversity. Last week, we discussed the potential application of Israeli sovereignty to parts of Judea and Samaria from Israel's point of view, what the possible choices are, how the Israeli government is managing it, U.S.-Israel relations on the subject. Today we're moving. We're going to consider the Gulf states and, among other things, how Israel's choices affect them and how they can affect Israel. In truth, I think people don't know much about the Gulf states. Saudi Arabia, yes, maybe. But to be honest, what do we really know about Bahrain or the UAE? And what difference do they make? Our guest, Simon Henderson of the Washington Institute, is going to make that clear to us, and he's going to make us all smarter. Simon is the Baker Fellow and Director of the Bernstein Program on Gulf and Energy Policy at the Washington Institute. He specializes in energy matters and the Arab states of the Persian Gulf. He's a former journalist with the Financial Times, and he has worked as a consultant advising corporations and governments on the Persian Gulf. He became an associate of the Washington Institute in 1999, joined the staff in 2016. He started his career with the British Broadcasting Service. He reported from Tehran during the 1979 revolution. Simon writes and appears frequently in the media, all the places that you would expect him to be, discussing the internal dynamics of the House of Saud, energy developments, events in the Gulf, and Pakistan's nuclear program. His latest publication is Nuclear Iran, Glossary of Terms, which he co-authored with former IAEA official Ali Honainen and was co-published with the Harvard Kennedy School's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs. He's the author of a paper entitled The New Pillar, Conservative Arab Gulf States and U.S. Strategy, and that will be the subject for today. Remember, if you have questions, you cannot ask them, or at least you can't ask them out loud. Please send your questions to info@jewishpolicycenter.org, and we'll be reading them. Simon, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, and I'm very pleased to be here to be able to speak to you all today. I am actually, despite my accent, I am an American citizen, and I'm speaking to you from my home in Georgetown here in Washington, D.C. The Gulf and Israel is a fascinating subject, but it's a very much a moving target. What makes it a considerable amount of fun. I wrote a piece for Shoshana 5 years ago on the GCC and Israel, which is worth looking at perhaps if you're really interested in the subject, because I sort of laid out where it was then, and my basic conclusion was that it was much further along the road than most people thought. 5 years on, now it's even further down that road. And I will explain a little why. I will start off, though, briefly showing you a map so that you can have in your mind's eye what I'm going to be talking about today. I think this is a US government map. It serves the purpose very well, but I'm going to be talking about the Gulf Cooperation Councils, which are Saudi Arabia, the big one in the middle, and then Kuwait at the top of the Persian Gulf, the small island of Bahrain, which is roughly speaking right in the middle of the Persian Gulf. Next door to that is Qatar, the peninsula of Qatar. And then we have the United Arab Emirates and also Oman. I've been to all these countries except Saudi Arabia. That might be sort of strange because I've written a lot on Saudi Arabia, and indeed my principal occupation is to write about Saudi Arabia, both in energy terms and in terms of the Saudi royal family. But I was never prepared to go through the various hoops the Saudis used to put up in order to get to Saudi Arabia. And then when I started writing about Saudi Arabia, they are no longer prepared to give me a visa. These days, I've written so much, which I would like to think has been constructive, that I won't be going to Saudi Arabia, even if they do offer me a visa. But I have been, apart from Egypt, Israel, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Iraq and Iran, and indeed Afghanistan and Pakistan, in the rest of these countries. Now, if we go back, drop the map for a moment. What I really want to talk to you about today is why there are relations between Israel and the Gulf states. And the simple answer is it's because of Iran. And that's the main answer and the main answer today. But in fact, it's also, there's another reason why there are relations, and that's to do with trade. Despite the Arab embargo of Israel from 1948 onwards, when the Gulf states emerged as important economies with the increase of the price of oil in the 60s and 70s, and when their oil revenues came on stream, these countries have been interested in trade with Israel. It varies from country to country, but it's been growing steadily, and it is the untold story of the relationship. It's an untold story which will, for most of the time, is probably better to remain untold, because I don't particularly want to put anybody at risk or anything like that. But it's a measure of the underlying relationship which has developed over the years. This has particularly been true of Oman, of Bahrain, of the United Arab Emirates, particularly the city, state and trading center of Dubai, and also Qatar. It's worthwhile remembering, or if you can't remember, at least worthwhile me telling you, that when Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated in Israel and he was given a state funeral, one of the guests at the state funeral was a Qatari minister who arrived there and was at the funeral dressed in what we would regard as traditional Arab dress. That was an early indication that it's often wrong to be too simplistic about the nature of the relationship. And it's not a black and white relationship, it's various shades of gray. And indeed, as time moves, the gray can either get less lighter or darker. And so this is fascinating to me because I was in Qatar a couple of years ago at a conference, and to my slight surprise, although I knew that it happened, there were Israelis at the conference as well. And the Israelis had been at the conference using their Israeli passports, for which they had visas to come to Qatar, and getting to Qatar by flying first to Jordan and then taking a flight from Jordan to Doha. There's a similar level of obvious activity in the United Arab Emirates, where a few years ago, Abu Dhabi, the capital, allowed Israel to establish a diplomatic presence there because of that Abu Dhabi wanted to play host to an international organization concerned with renewable energy. And if you host an international organization, the rules of the game is you have to let everybody be there. And so Israel has an office there. I think for most of the time, the office is empty. People travel in and out as necessary, but there is an office there. And also Dubai has been a trading center for Israel for many years. The diplomatic status of its presence there is unclear, and I am not about to clarify it, but watch this space. An example of the sort of thing which has gone on is that an Israeli diplomat once said to me, before things got better with the United Arab Emirates, that he'd been to Abu Dhabi. And I said, why did you go? And he said, well, it was something the Americans put together for us. They said to the UAE and to Israel, you're both allies of the United States, you should talk to each other. As part of this talking to each other, a group of Israelis, including my acquaintance, flew again via Jordan on Israeli passports to Abu Dhabi, where they had some formal meetings with the UAE foreign ministry, and they presented their perspectives on things in the region, and the Emiratis presented their own perspective. And my Israeli contact said there wasn't much agreement, but we at least listened to each other. Well, things have moved on, and these days there's quite a lot of agreement on, particularly between the Emirates and Israel. The Saudi Arabia is also a main center for this sort of developing relationship with Israel, particularly because of the influence of the up-and-coming Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, known widely as MBS. And he has made it clear not quite publicly, but almost publicly, that as far as he's concerned, developing relations with Israel is the important way forward for his country and for the region. The only country, or the country which is slowest to develop relations with Israel, quietly and certainly openly, is Kuwait. But I'm told, and I've been in Kuwait and had this sort of discussion with Kuwaitis, that there are Israeli contacts with Kuwait as well. Now, the modern context for this is Iran. And Israel has its own anxieties about Iran, and many of these anxieties, particularly on the nuclear issue, overlap with Gulf anxieties about Iran. And so it's become a natural contact for there to be views, exchange of views, and indeed cooperation between Israel and the Gulf states. And these have been, I think, pretty well established by now, at least on the military and intelligence level, as well, of course, as I previously explained, on the trading level as well, the commercial level. But in the sense of, is there going to be diplomatic recognition? I think, although that is at least talked about at the moment, it is going to be elusive for a while. One of the main reasons why it's elusive is the possibility of Israel annexing parts of the West Bank, which is a public area of policy disagreement and of concern with Arab public opinion, that we would be foolish, I think, to think that Israel could get away with it, even on a small level, without some reaction. I will perhaps be proven wrong on this, but let's wait until it happens. Then I will decide whether on the extent of what's happening and the timing of what's happening, of what is going on. So let me draw my remarks to an end again at this point and open up to questions. I have a particular view which I will throw out to you as a way of challenging what your conceptions are, which is that Israel's relations with the Gulf states have developed very well and are actually very rewarding to both sides. But it might well be best that they only remain at that less than official and public level so that they can grow even more, both in closeness of the relationships and in the size of the commercial relationship. This would be a way of moving the relationship forward, seeking public recognition, diplomatic recognition, is a target, I think, for the future rather than for the now. Shoshana.
Thank you, Simon. Thank you for a really good introduction to things that we need to understand. So we talk about what the Gulf states do, or any Arab country does, or any country does, with Israel. And you have to ask a second question. One of our listeners is asking, how much of this do the people of those countries know about the relationship? Is it a problem for the governments to be dealing with Israel? And have they talked to the people? Is it a secret? Do they feel that it would hinder the relations if their people knew?
These countries don't talk to the people about what the governments of these countries think is not particularly the people's business to know about. That's the general statement, and it's there are some particular angles there which are worth mentioning. There is a substantial sympathy at a popular level for the Palestinians. This isn't particularly surprising. And it's, apart from anything else, it's a consequence of decades worth of information and education, which has been sympathetic towards the Palestinians and has often depicted the Israelis as evil in a variety of forms. So you can't sort of change this situation overnight. Some of this might also be an active sentiment within the intelligentsia of these countries. But these countries are, although they pay attention to one extent or another to public opinion, They're not democracies by any stretch of the imagination. So the leadership of these countries, and frankly, it often comes down to the top person himself, who can make up his own mind this way or that on what to do. The leadership is fearful of Iran, looking around for allies. Times like this, strangely enough, America is historically being the traditional ally to look for. The fact that there are question marks about Americans' ability to and willingness to provide military support for some of these countries mean that they are thinking other ways of doing it, and a relationship with Israel might be another way of doing it. The fact that what would appear to be the case that Israel has done some incredible piece of destruction on part of the Natanz enrichment plant in Iran in recent days is in Gulf minds probably a reflection or adds to the view that Israel does things rather than the United States, which talks about doing things but doesn't actually do things.
So this raises several questions about Palestinians, about Iran, about Natanz. Let's start with Iran and Natanz. So you've written an article in which you point out that the Natanz bombing, and there were other bombings in Iran, which you may want to make mention of, was probably a centrifuge facility. Can you talk to us about why now? Why, in your view, would this have been an opportune moment for Israel or anybody else, because the Israelis don't take credit, to do that?
Well, I am. I've written about centrifuges over the years, so I know a few things about centrifuges. But
share them.
On much of the information of what's happening in Iran, I have been reliant on news reports as other people. I take note that there have been a variety of incidents. I also take note that Benny Gantz, the defense minister and the alternative prime minister, has said not everything happens in Iran is necessarily to do with us. This is probably the case. The significance, though, is that it's twofold on Natanz. One is that the Natanz enrichment plant, the actual enrichment plant itself, is buried in a deep hole in the ground, which is covered with concrete and iron mesh, and for most purposes is impenetrable and indestructible. But the facility where something went on, it's been severely damaged, was a centrifuge assembly plant, which is where you put the centrifuge together before you install it along with hundreds of other centrifuges in the enrichment plant itself. And this assembly plant was a building on the surface and, as far as I can make out, was not reinforced in any way and appears to have been almost completely destroyed. This will have the effect of, could have the effect, and again, there are considerable limits on my knowledge on this, of delaying centrifuge production. I'm unaware that Iran has any alternative centrifuge assembly plant. And in order to increase both the quantity of enriched uranium that it has, and crucially, the degree of enrichment to make it highly enriched uranium, Iran needs more centrifuges. particularly of a more advanced type than most of the centrifuges it has, and the ones which it was allowed to retain under the JCPOA of 2015. And if this is the case that this assembly plant has been destroyed, then Iran's ability to make the advanced centrifuges has been stopped. Okay, they can build another assembly plant, but all this takes time. And so Iran has been delayed for months, perhaps even years.
So as a point of information, these would be the centrifuges that when the sunset clauses of the JCPOA kick in, these are the ones that Tehran would be using. So isn't it really a matter of timing? Either they get them earlier by cheating, or they get them later by living up to the terms of the deal and having the sunset. Or not.
You're verging into diplomacy rather than technical matters. And, you know, even if it is the case that Israel has attacked this facility and destroyed it, tomorrow is another day. It might not be tomorrow in the sense of 24 hours, but next year, 5 years' time, 10 years' time, as far as we know, Iran, the country, will still be there. Maybe it won't have the same regime. Maybe it won't even perhaps be an Islamic Republic as it is today. Things change. But in terms of dealing with the current crisis and winning valuable time, this certainly appears to have been a success. But we might well now be in for a period of diplomacy where we can alter some of the conditions of the JCPOA or force Iran to accept some altered conditions. Of course, will they accept them? What will they do on the quiet? I don't know. We'll see. You'll have to ask me again.
Does that mean you'll come back and do this again? That's great. Thank you. Let's go back to the Gulf states and the Palestinians. Among the things that you said was that the people of the Gulf states do feel for the Palestinian cause. They've been taught to do that. They do that. They believe that. So the Palestinians are important to them at a certain level. Do the Palestinians control how the Gulf states proceed on this issue? Or do the Gulf states have influence on how the Palestinians might proceed? Is it possible to expect? Because there were, as you know, Gulf state representatives in the White House when the president produced his plan. Do those people have influence on the Palestinian Authority?
As far as I can see, not much. Mahmoud Abbas has a farm in Qatar, but I don't think he ever goes there. I think the other Palestinian leadership might have apartments in the Gulf. There used to be a time when the Palestinian leadership relied substantially on Arab countries for funding. That is no longer the case. And so their ability to listen to the Gulf states has been reduced. The exception there has been Qatar, which has been funding relief in Gaza. This is often depicted as being funding Hamas. To the best of my understanding, and I've asked Americans, Qataris, Palestinians on this, that the money is very tightly controlled and goes to individual families in Gaza, and it's orchestrated with the assistance of Israel, who for most of the time are very grateful for the money because it's one of the contributions to keeping tempers in Gaza cool, or certainly cooler than what they otherwise might be. But that sort of Gulf influence on the Palestinians has been reduced over the years. And the way it's depicted, and I think it's, I probably agree with it, it's a sense of exasperation with the Palestinians that they haven't been willing to try and sort it all out with Israel. The Palestinians would, of course, say, well, we've never been offered a deal which we would find acceptable. But without going down that particular path, I think the bottom line there is that every time an element of a plan or a deal is suggested these days, it's less to the Palestinians' advantage. Unless, you know, governments change here in the United States or in Europe or indeed even in the Middle East, and what people want in terms of sorting out Israel and Palestine, it becomes the framework for negotiation changes.
So this prompted two other questions, one about Qatar, one about Jerusalem. When the United States decided to move the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem from Tel Aviv and essentially recognize Israel's claim to sovereignty over both halves of Jerusalem, there was a belief that the Arab world would explode, the Arab street would explode, that this would be the cause of upheaval, major upheaval. It was not the cause of major upheaval. It was hardly the cause of minor upheaval. If you compare what people respond to, do you think that there will be a bigger or a lesser response if Israel applies sovereignty to parts of the West Bank than there was to essentially asserting its sovereignty over all of Jerusalem?
One of the reasons that I write about the Gulf is so that I don't write about Israel and Palestine, for which there are far too many people who write about it.
And but I want to know about the Gulf state reactions, not
okay,
the Palestinian
fine.
Reaction.
Okay.
Gulf state reaction.
No. It's not going to be in the Gulf states where there's going to be a particular reaction to any annexation. I would look for the reaction and would monitor the reaction carefully is Jordan, which, as we well know, has a population which of what Jordanian Arabs, which are known as the East, plus many Palestinians or people who regard themselves as Palestinians or whose roots were originally in what was at one point the British Mandate of Palestine until 1948. The degree to which they will be affected or indeed concerned about annexation is the issue. On the Gulf states, we've had some interesting pieces, elements of reaction so far, or preemptive reaction, most notably from the United Arab Emirates, which has been opening up towards Israel on a public level. They sent within a matter of a couple of weeks two planes to Tel Aviv with aid for the Palestinians related to the coronavirus. One plane, the first plane, was all white, i.e. it had no national markings on it. The second plane was in the colors of Etihad, which is the airline of Abu Dhabi. This was seen as what could be the case if Israel doesn't annex anything. And this sense was increased by Yosef Alateba, who's the Emirati ambassador here in Washington, D.C., who wrote a piece which was translated into Hebrew and published in the Israeli newspaper Yediot Ahronot, and the headline of which summed up the whole thing, which was, you can have annexation or you can have normalization, but you can't have both. This was slightly undermined by another Emirati minister, Anwar Gargash, who was quoted as saying something similar, but not quite the same. So people wondered, why the ambiguity? And then the effective ruler of the UAE, who's the crown prince of Abu Dhabi, a man called Mohammed bin Zayed, often known simply as MBZ, came out saying he was against annexation, at which point everybody said, there you are, they're against annexation. That's their real position. Lo and behold, a few days later, it's announced that an Emirati companies have signed agreements with Israeli companies to work on ideas and technology related to dealing with the coronavirus. So it goes back to the basic question, what is the tolerance level for annexation by the United Arab Emirates? And why can't they get their message as clear as the average person who's looking to work out what their message is would want it? At which point I say, welcome to the Gulf. You know, that's the way, if you want consistency and lack of ambiguity, you come to the wrong place.
Okay, that makes it a lot clearer. So now clear up something else for us. You mentioned Qatar, and I know that the aid that goes from Qatar to Gaza, as you said, is done in cooperation with Israel. But we tend to think of the Gulf states as kind of having the same policies, but Qatar and Saudi Arabia clearly do not. Could you talk to us about the relations between the two of them, Qatar being a supporter of Erdogan in Turkey and some things that MBS is not necessarily a supporter of. Talk about Qatar and Saudi Arabia.
I've just written 4,000 or 5,000 words on this.
Tell us where to find them. Wait. Promote this. Tell us where to find them.
If you go on the Washington Institute website and click on experts, you'll find a whole variety of my colleagues. I am there. Click on my name and you'll come to what I've written recently. And I've written a piece which, not speculatively, but sort of considered what would happen if Qatar was no longer ruled by Amir Tamim, who's a young man, it's still in his 30s, who is the ruler. It's called Qatar Without Tamim. And it goes in to, apart from a load of history and family relationships, this rift between Qatar on the one side and Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Bahrain, and indeed Egypt on the other, who are effectively trying to blockade. Qatar, I think the way of summing up Qatar and its relationship with the other Gulf states is that Qatar regards itself as not necessarily a team player. So it won't agree with the other Gulf states. And it has an irritating habit of doing irritating things like allowing in exiles, which upset other countries. It's not as if the exiles do much plotting in Qatar. They're told to shut up and sit quietly. But that's not the view taken by Saudi Arabia and not the view certainly taken by the UAE. But as I said at the beginning, it's not as if Qatar hasn't been friendly indeed in the past to Israel. Frankly, I think wants to look to be friendly again with Israel. A Qatari friend a year or so said, pointed out to me that when Qatar first established less than formal relations with Israel, they allowed an Israeli trade office in Doha and were going to set up a Qatari trade office in Tel Aviv or Ramat Gan. It annoyed considerably the other Gulf states, of which Saudi Arabia and the Emirates were the two of the ones which were most annoyed. And eventually, under the pressure from those countries and the circumstances of the time, Qatar broke off those relationships, although they didn't shut the Israeli trade office quite as abruptly as they publicly announced. My Qatari friend explained to me, he said, if only we hadn't stopped public relations with Israel. And he said, do you know what? The amount of pressure that we had from Saudi Arabia and the Emirates to cut those relations with Israel was extraordinary. I don't know the details of the pressure, but I can imagine it was pretty heavy. But I'm pointing out to you that it's an ingredient which is very much a family squabble, which, like many family squabbles, might be sort of settled at any particular moment, but the background of it, frankly, continues for a long, long time. It might publicly be settled, but I don't think it's about to be settled. And in the meantime, from the context that I've had, Qatar seeks to walk a delicate balance. It's friendly with Turkey because, other people aren't friendly with Turkey, so it looks to particularly big countries which might be able to help it out. And it's also, it's certainly not as friendly to to Iran as Emirates and Saudi Arabia would like to allege. And it seeks to have decent relations with Israel. When I was in Doha a couple of years ago, and again, I wrote about this again, you'll find it on the Washington Institute website. I went to meet the Qatari envoy to Gaza, a man called Mohammed Al-Amoudi, who is in real life is a construction businessman, but has taken on this role of being the envoy to Gaza, and was telling me tales about going to Israel and how much he enjoyed going there, and which hotel he stayed in Jerusalem when he was there, and who he was meeting in Kogat, which is the Israeli Ministry of Defense organization, which deals with relations with the occupied territories. So there's hope there. It's not like Iran, where I don't think, frankly, there's much hope whatsoever of any sort of Israel-Iran rapprochement. But there are levels of communication between the Gulf states and Israel, which continue and are active, even if their own intra-Gulf relationships are tense.
Thank you. That's something to keep eyes on. Something that very few people are keeping eyes on anymore seems to be the war in Yemen. Americans don't look at it. It's not in our media. It's not of interest. We have just a few minutes left, but a reader asks us, does the war in Yemen matter outside the country and outside of the misery that comes to the people of Yemen? Or is that a subject for a whole other?
No. It's a very good question. And it's a very relevant question. The simple answer there is that Yemen has become a place for a proxy war, a proxy rivalry between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And if we can break down the level of war, we might be able to undermine that rivalry, might be able to force Iran out of it. As Saudi Arabia wants to get out of it, but only on terms which it can depict as victory. So far, all it's had there is defeats and setbacks. But the other point the questioner makes, is it always going to be like this? Is it always going to be a sad, poor country where people suffer? I fear the answer is yes, although at the moment they're particularly suffering because of war, and they're particularly suffering as a consequence of that war of food shortages. They're facing a humanitarian disaster. And so if we can get rid of the war, we might be able to deal with the humanitarian disaster. But if you ask me in 20 years' time, is Yemen still going to be a mess? The answer is yes.
So that's a very depressing note on which to end. Can you say one positive thing so that we get out of here feeling uplifted instead of not uplifted?
The positive thing is that Israel and the Gulf states have some interesting and developing relations, which are mutually advantageous. And that's something which is well established, so well established that it's easy to build on it. Don't take it too much for granted, and don't look too much for public displays of friendship and diplomatic relations. But there's a lot going on, and it behind the scenes, behind the headlines, it changes the fundamentals of Israel's position in the Middle East.
That is a great note on which to say thank you very much. I think we've learned a lot. Our listeners seem to have learned a lot. We've got lots of questions. Simon, thank you. And to everybody who is on the call, we will be back next week with Ilya Shapiro, who's going to talk to us about the Supreme Court session that will be ended by then. So you'll get an invitation in the mail, and we hope to have you with us again next week for Ilya Shapiro. Thank you, everybody. Simon, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.